5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The Southeast Linux Fest is a community event for anyone who wants to learn more about Linux and free and open source software. It is part educational conference and part social gathering. Like Linux itself, it is shared with the attendees of all skill levels to communicate tips and ideas and to benefit all who use Linux and free and open source software. The Linux Fest is a place to learn, to make new friends, to network with new business partners, and most importantly, to have fun. Come join us for the first annual Southeast Linux Fest on June 13, 2009 in Clemson, South Carolina. Register today at southeastlinuxfest.org.
Give me a T!
T!
L!
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 T!
T!
S!
S!
What's that spell?
Drugs!
It's a little thing tech show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the guests, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that are like a bath. For the streaming, go direct to DLNGS.org. And I see channels at LinuxLink.net. Bound tech show. Just sit right there, cause the castle's just about to begin.
The Linux Link Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Another exciting episode of the Linux Link Tech Show. This is episode 298. Today is Wednesday, May 13th, 2009. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
How you doing, Dan?
Doing well. How are you?
Excellent.
We got Dave Alan, Yates.
Back in action.
And Alan.
Back here, yes.
Dave Yates, back from Jamaica.
And special Hola. Guest, Thomas, from the Command
hey.
Line podcast.
Hey, everybody.
Welcome
how's
Thomas.
My audio? How's my audio sound, Pat?
You sound great now.
All right, that's good. Before we get into talking with Thomas, I did want to make a comment slash announcement slash apology, whatever you want to call it.
Excellent, Dan. Good to hear it. You might want to hit the unmute button when you're doing your apology thing.
He just can't apologize.
Or maybe you need to be on a better machine connected to your VoIP client.
You need to get him a longer extension
card. I'd be glad to apologize for Dan.
Dave's apologizing. So, Dave, how was your vacation?
Yeah, it was good. Good and short.
Relaxing?
Yep. I didn't do anything.
So, did you like Jamaica better than the Dominican Republic, or...?
No. It's not as nice. Not as pretty. It was cooler there than I thought, though. It was okay.
Would you go for a week?
Yeah, I went for a week.
I can use a week of vacation somewhere nice.
I'm ready for the next one.
I've got one coming up, and unfortunately it's called a furlough, so...
How long is that, a week?
Yeah, I'll pull a week off. Gonna do it the week after the Southeast Linux Fest. Hopefully my wife will be back at work and it'll be good.
Dave, they're asking in the IRC where in Jamaica you were.
It's between Montego Bay and Negril, near a town called Lucy.
And would you go back?
Sort of resort or something down there?
Yeah, it was a resort. My wife would. I would. I wouldn't vote for there again, though.
You didn't like it?
No, it was beautiful, but they didn't have the kind of beach that I'm used to. The beaches appeared to be man-made. Not a traditional-looking beach. But that may have been just a resort. I only saw just a little bit of Jamaica, but it was alright.
People saying you're really in Jamaica, New York, not in Jamaica, Jamaica.
Jamaica, South Carolina.
Jamaica, New York. You're out in Queens. Rockaway Beach.
That explains it. Rockaway Beach.
That explains it.
Rock, Rockaway Beach.
So is Thomas still there, or did he drop off too?
No, I'm still here.
Okay. You were very quiet, so I wasn't sure if you're still around. So, Thomas, you do the Command Line podcast?
Yeah, I sure do. I've been doing I've heard
it a few times, and I enjoyed what you were doing. So for anybody who doesn't know, can you just give us a little background what you do on the show?
Sure. What I do is, well, it's just me, and occasionally I do interviews. It's been something I've been doing increasingly of late. I've been able to pull in some very interesting folks from the likes of, actually, some of the folks that you've had on, Cory Doctorow amongst them, but
Corey's
also
great.
Bringing in, yeah, Cory's, I've had him on actually a couple of times, and I always enjoy that. But recently I had John Zittrain, I've had Ed Felton, Bruce Schneier, Harry Lessig to talk about their research, how it interacts with public policy and technology. That's just kind of a go-to topic that I return to week in and week out. There's always more to explore there, but I talk a little bit about Linux, other kinds of technology, free and open source software, and many other unrelated pursuits that are equally geeky.
Such as?
Oh, well, I'll do in the intro, just to talk out my bed music, I'll do quick reviews of books that I've read recently, movies that I've seen, games I've played with the kids, either video games or recently our whole family's gotten into tabletop gaming. That's always fun to trot out the latest game that's totally the antithesis of Milton Bradley or Parker Brothers or the crap games that we grew up with.
Sounds like Dan is back.
Did I drop off?
Completely.
You just disappeared.
What the heck happened? What was I? What did I get? Where was I when I was lost? When I got lost?
I want to apologize, blank.
All right. Well, you guys just continue on. I will apologize afterwards.
Well, Dave apologized for you, Dan. So you're
okay. Then I will apologize again. And if it happens one more time, I am switching to the other machine. But I'm sorry. Please, continue on.
So what are some cool tabletop games that you consider not sucky?
Oh, well, the one we played most recently was Pandemic, and I cannot recommend that game highly enough. Some friends of ours, fellow congoers and sci-fi geeks, brought it over and introduced it to us, and I don't know if any of you guys have ever played Arkham Horror, which is a very elaborate, very involved, cooperative tabletop game. It takes several hours to set up and several more hours to play. But that cooperative aspect, lends a very different feel to the strategy of the game and the gameplay. So I like to describe Pandemic for people who've heard of or better yet played Arkham Horror as Arkham Horror Lite. So it's got that cooperative gameplay. The rules are very engaging. It's highly replayable. It's got the same sort of potboiler element that Arkham Horror has. So as the game progresses, things get more and more intense. And but it doesn't take an hour and a half to set up and 4 hours to play. I mean, you can literally set it up in 30 seconds, and you can play as quickly as 5 or 10 minutes, or if you've got a particularly intense game, maybe 45 minutes or an hour.
Is this a card-based game?
No, No. Pandemic is the board setup is actually very similar to Risk, of all things. It's token-based. There are cards involved in the way that cards are involved in Risk. They tie into the board, and they give you things that you can do during your term that involve the board, like enhanced movement, or what you're trying to do, the goal of the whole game that you're cooperating towards is stopping these four raging global pandemics. And so you have to collect cards for each one to get a sufficient amount in order to dowdle it's on board game. Or you can search for it on my website, just responding to somebody in the chat room. So it's not a card-based game in the sense of like a collectible card game like Magic the Gathering, which I'm sure everybody's familiar with. But there is a component that involves collecting the cards and even trading the cards.
That sounds really interesting.
So what's the age range on this?
We haven't played it with either of our kids yet. I think the complexity might be a little too high for them. But I think if you've got teenagers, absolutely. I think probably our 10-year-old maybe is on the cusp of being able to get enough of the rules. Really, it's more that cooperative aspect that I think is the limiter. That what I found with both of my kids is if you have a traditional game, you know, traditional zero-sum game, they kind of get that a little bit better. If you've got something like Pandemic or there's any number of other newer games out that are like that, that sometimes takes them a little longer to grasp that. And I've certainly played with some teenagers, kids of friends of mine, who sometimes take a perverse delight, it's just them being kids, in trying to stop everybody else or interfere with everybody else's play. So it depends. You know, if you have a lot of patience, I would say maybe when they're younger, probably pull them in if you're not looking to get. But this game is so addictive. It's so hard to beat at the outset. That we just found that when we started playing it, we'd have friends over to play, we'd share dinner and drinks with them, and then we'd set everything aside and get real serious, you know, lay the board out, and this time we were determined we were going to beat it.
Now, for the younger kids, have you tried to ease them into other board games like Carcassonne or anything?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Carcassonne is definitely one of our family favorites. And I think it was one of the first games that our friends introduced us to when we started playing kind of this newer generation of tabletop games like Carcassonne, Settlers of Catan, Ticket to Ride, Transamerica, all of these wonderful games that have come out in recent years that are just, they're so well produced, they're so much more involved and interesting than, as I said, a lot of the kind of very vanilla, not very interesting fare that we grew up on. So Carcassonne's a good one. We received Cheeky Monkey as a gift. That's a great one because it's just a simple token game. So there's no dice, no cards, no complex rules, and the name of the game, Cheeky Monkey, is actually probably the most complex rule in the game and very easy to get. It's just a wrinkle that kind of makes things interesting. Sputnik's a good one that we've played with them. Tsuro is my younger son, who's 6, he'll be 7 in another month. Loved Tsuro, and that's another one. It's a tile placement game and a line following game. So it's very straightforward, and he's actually at the point where some of the most recent times that we've played that, he's just starting to grasp sort of the strategy, thinking ahead a little bit, because you're trying to extend your line and stay on the board as long as possible in Tsuro while trying to drive your opponents off of the board. And so when he was younger and first started playing it, didn't quite get that, and would end up driving himself very early on in the game right off the board. And now you can kind of see, you know, when he's waiting to play his next turn, you can kind of see the gears turning, that he's calculating, you know, which of the couple of tiles he has in his hand is probably going to be the best one to play next.
You ever play Ticket to Ride? It's a train game.
No, I've played Transamerica, which is, as I understand it, very similar, but I have friends who rave about Ticket to Ride. We just haven't had a chance to play it yet.
Yeah, that's a great game. You ought to play that if you get a chance.
We keep planning to, but there's just, I'll be honest, there's so many great games, and there are more coming out. Have you heard, any of you guys heard of, I think it's Power Grid, which is, again, very similar to Ticket to Ride, Transamerican, and Settlers, in that you're kind of building a network and kind of connecting things, and that network aspect's critical. It's even gone into, I think there's an expansion that just came out. So there's always something new to try, and that's the problem. There's already a lot of great games out there, and I'd love to play Ticket to Ride, but when we sit down with our friends, especially the ones with more disposable income because they don't have kids, they've always got something new, and you want to try the something new first.
I remember back in the day I used to play Axis and Allies, and it took like as long to set the darn game up as it did to play sometimes.
Well, then you should definitely try Pandemic.
It looks really cool.
Oh, it's fantastic. And there's an expansion coming out soon.
Now, do you get most of your games from Board Game Geek?
Well, I might research them, but we're lucky enough to have a couple of places that we can go to locally. We're just outside of Washington, D.C. on the Maryland side. And so we've got Dream Wizards in town here, and then if you head up towards Laurel, up near the NSA, the Puzzle Palace, there's a fantastic game store in a historic Savage Mill, which is this great. It's an old textile mill they've turned into this really neat sort of shopping mall, but it's all little bespoke shops and so forth. And there's the Family Game Store in Savage Mill, and we get a lot of stuff there because we're friends of the owners, and so we get a lot of recommendations, and he can order stuff. He doesn't have it in stock. He also tends to cater to the tabletop war gamers too, so if you're into that, he carries a lot of that as well. But the fun thing about his store in particular is that when you go in there, as opposed to ordering it from online, it's the way the owner has laid it out. It's very clever. So at the one end, you've got kind of the deeper end of the game. So you have all the war games and the miniatures and the really involved diehard stuff. And then as you walk through to the back of the store, you get to the slightly less involved. Then you get to more kind of the family-oriented. And then he's even got a kid's play area set up in the back that's got some stuff that's really targeted explicitly right at toddlers. And he'll have a lot of the games out and open where you can play them. And on a regular basis, the store owner also hosts a game night. So we'll go up there every other month or three, and a lot of people come in and not only play some of the demo games from the store, but we'll also bring some of their favorite games from their own collections and share those out. So it's a great way to sample and kind of decide what you want to buy next.
Now, do you do role-playing games also, or are you just strictly board?
I did when I was younger, and if I had more time and perhaps more friends that were into it that also had more time, because it's the kind of thing, I know some people are doing it online with good effect, and there are a couple of interesting projects to do kind of virtual gaming tables online, but just trying to find, you know, several hours where the friends that do play could get together and just dedicate that time, especially when at this point, most of my friends are also podcasters, so we're all hunkered down to our mixers and, you know, recording and writing and editing and such.
That's when you sit down to do a D&D podcast like some other people do. And you just record your session. At the local
Aren't there enough of those
shop.
Ready?
Yeah, I think so. I was going to say, because I used to be big into D&D, and we used to get out to the point of doing the little miniatures and stuff. And I got the 4th edition for my family over Christmas, and we've been playing it off and on. And one of the things I noticed with that is back in the day, you used to go out and buy the pewter or lead figures and have to sit down and paint them and everything. And nowadays, what I notice is a lot of them are coming out with already painted plastic figures, which kind of takes a little bit of that fun away, I thought, but at the same time, it's a lot easier to get up and going with some nice figures. But
No, I hear that. I definitely grew up at that time when we were doing hand-painted miniatures. And I have an older brother who was amazing at it. I think he has a much stronger artistic leaning than I ever did. And it just, it always floored me, the detail he was able to get and just the end product that he came up with, sitting down and the concentration that went into that. And then, to your point, the fun that you would have actually using those to lay a map out and to play the campaign just really kind of was the payoff. You know, you spent however many hours actually detailing your character, you know, picking the right one, searching them down, or a lot of the stuff that he did towards the end before he got out of it was even some of the larger, almost some of the pieces that you'll see set up like in game stores as part of their dioramas. So get very intricate from that perspective.
Sweet. Now, you had mentioned that you and your friends are really into podcasting now, and that's how I learned about you was through word of mouth about the Command Line podcast. And I have to say, it's at commandline.net. It's been a really fascinating and interesting show that you do, and what I just wanted to come on and hopefully encourage other people to listen to it after they've heard you speak and get some background information on you and your show, because you've been in the industry, the technical industry, programming for at least 10 years now, correct?
Yeah, it's going on 14, I want to say.
And is that where you started? I mean, did you actually have official schooling as in computer science?
Oh, hell no. No. We always had computers in the home growing up. My dad, when he started his first business when he got out of the Navy, was leasing time on a big iron system to do number crunching. He started a small research firm doing market research. And that was the way he could do a lot more with a lot less. And then when I was old enough to kind of be aware of that stuff, they had a Data General Mini in his office. And I still have memories of him taking me into the old computer room they had there where it was, you know, ice cold as these things were, had the raised flooring, had the washing machine-sized hard drive with the giant platters in it. We always had modems from the very earliest days, from 300 baud onward. We had acoustic coupling modems. We had one that was a briefcase pack that he took with him on the road. Green screen terminals. We had a Dasher 80 in the house. We actually had a couple of them. And a TI teletype. And so it was always just kind of a fixture growing up. And when I went to school, I really, I kind of lacked focus, you could say. So I hopped majors every year. It was almost kind of a running gag with my dad. And what kept me in technology was actually the job I had during school, kind of help pay the bills and earn spending money, was to work for tech services. So I was doing desktop support, network support, for the student labs until they shut those down right before I graduated, and for faculty and staff. And then that led to my very first job out of school, which was doing more of the same, but instead of for a college, for a large company. It was Allied Signal, just at their pilot plant just south of Richmond. And then it was in that job where I was very lucky enough that the bubble was just starting about a year and a half in, and was able to kind of hop over to do some web programming very early on. I mean, Perl and CGI, kind of that vintage. And at that point, that was the start of a trajectory that's pretty much continuous to what I'm doing today.
So are you primarily programming in Perl still?
No, I've gone through a couple of different languages. I'm prepared to take my my licks. For the people who no doubt are no big fans of Java, but that's how I pay my bills these days. My personal projects tend to run a little bit farther afield. I've got a couple of open source projects that I tinker on in Python and PHP as well.
So what languages don't you do? I mean, do you do C, C++,
Haskell,
.NET?
I stay away from .NET. I did Microsoft coding with ASP before it was ASP.NET. I actually survived the bubble doing some of that and saw that really, I didn't say .NET or C#, thankfully. I managed to dodge that bullet. I really saw how that stuff didn't scale very well. It was around the same time that I was really starting to experiment with Linux for the first time, and that really, thankfully, kind of took me off in a different direction. But I've done, I've done some low-level C, more for scientific programming, not really so much C++, but enough to realize that if I had stuck with just what I do in my day job, I'd be missing out on a lot. And so it's one of the things that I will try to track and talk about on my podcast is other languages, kind of where they're at, new languages that are coming up, like Vala and D and some of the other interesting stuff that's come out of the free and open source world and from other sources besides.
So since you are largely self-taught and had eased into the or moved into the field naturally without any schooling, how do you feel about the environment today compared to what it was like 10 years ago? I mean, is it moving in positive directions? Do you see a lot of good stuff, or are you seeing a lot of crap compared to the way it used to be?
It's cyclical. You know, like a lot of the Web 2.0 stuff that we're seeing is as most folks who've been playing with web applications, especially rich web applications that are using JavaScript, HTML before we had Ajax, that's continuous. You know, we've been doing this all throughout. It's not like when the first bubble burst in the 90s, people stopped doing what they're doing. People have been continuing to try to figure out how to build richer and richer and more capable applications, just because I think primarily, you know, you look at like jQuery by John Resick, you get a sense that guy's doing it because he's just fascinated by this stuff, not because he has any other kind of real motivation. He's really got a kind of a geek motivation for doing that. You still have these arguments about should software developers be certified, you know, if they're building such critical systems. That debate's certainly not new. You certainly see discussions about, it was kind of where I thought you were going with this question, but with the academic background, right, is the CS curriculum today adequately preparing the graduate to get a job and actually do work? And you have a lot of involved debate about that, about is it really the theoretics or is it really the more practical, and is there enough practical in the curriculum? That was going on 10 years ago, too, to be fair. So from that professional perspective, I think if it's different, it's incrementally different. If it's improved, it's just improved, in a stepwise fashion. It's not, if you look back, you go back and read software development before they kind of folded back into Dr. Dobbs' journal, had some nice flashbacks to the magazine they were 10 or 20 years prior. And you read through those, and it's the same kinds of discussions and the same kinds of arguments that we were having today, but back then. And, you know, you get to, I think, kind of a point that if you step back a little bit and you look at some of the antecedents, then you realize that there may be new things, but they're not fundamentally new. You know, they're improvements. They're slightly building off in interesting and new directions. But a lot of the core stuff that we're playing with really is much more continuous than you'd think.
So you are paying the bills with Java mostly these days. And now, does the work that you do right now, do you produce a product, or are you working for, you know, a company and designing and working on software that they use? I mean, is it something that actually gets boxed, packaged, and sold?
Well, yeah. I mean, for various values of packaged, yes. I work for a company that produces educational software. And so it's they actually have a product. I don't know that it's shrink-wrapped because it's sold to institutions, not individuals. So I think it's distributed almost exclusively online, but it's a recognizable name. We work with one of the biggies in that space. And what we're working on now is more software as a service, and that's actually more consistent with most of the stuff that I've done since the bubble.
So that's interesting to me, because you said you're working on educational software. Is that, I mean, what is it targeting? Primary, secondary education?
The company that I work for targets higher education, mostly colleges. The software that we produce, the software that we uncomfortably partner with, also is used, but it's used outside of higher education, outside of colleges mostly, but not very frequently. You know, it's usually the exception that some high school or middle school, some K through 12, has the software installed.
So because it's Java-based, then I would gather it is cross-platform?
Yeah, but since it's software as a service, I mean, the older product that we produce, there are people who are running it on, predominantly they are running it on Linux, but there are some people who are running it on Windows servers as well, as much as we don't like to have to support that. But the software as a service offering that we're developing now and getting ready to launch is... we run that on Linux across the board. We run that on Linux for internal testing and development, and our data centers, our production servers are all definitely running. They're running a CentOS.
That's kind of refreshing to hear, because I know a lot of stuff, even though it might be in the cloud or as a service, they still pigeonhole you into using Microsoft or... requiring that you have Internet Explorer, or sometimes they're even supporting Safari, but Linux is left out of the groups there, and that's unfortunate.
Well, we tend to develop for Firefox first, and I'll be honest. I mean, I use Firefox on a daily basis. I have since it was Phoenix or Firebird before that. I mean, the 0.9 series run up when that was all, you know, fresh and new and light and clean and fast compared to bad old Mozilla. But that's a little bit of enlightened self-interest. Firefox just does such a better job of adhering to the specs. It makes it so much easier to do clean layouts with CSS, correct behaviors with JavaScript. It has its own quirks and irritations, but it's far less frustrating. And because it is open source software, there's a better community, there's a lot better material out there. You even have a glimmer of a chance in hell of getting a patch from the Mozilla developers to address something that's legitimately an issue. And you can go and read their online discussions, read their blogs and forums, and there's just a lot more to draw on. Thankfully, because I tend to adhere more to the system side, closer to the database, more in the lower level layers of the applications that I've been building over the years, I have had to do some cross-browser compatibility stuff, but in the last handful of years I've been able to skirt around some of that, and just this past week got saddled with some bugs in the release candidate that were IE specific, and I'm on my Ubuntu box, firing up VirtualBox, trying to get IE7 up and running quickly enough so I can deploy out and test through it. And then I'm banging my head against the wall because, there's Firebug Lite, but there's nothing that's like the Firebug extension in Firefox that lets you tear apart a running web application in the browser. And it's infuriating. I mean, how many years have we had all this great tooling that the Mozilla guys have put out there and all the third-party developers have helped build up, and Microsoft still what? You know, you got a script debugger that it might work if you you cross your fingers and you make nice with it, but it's really pretty anemic.
Hey, now, Internet Explorer 8's coming out. Maybe they'll get their act together by 9.
I rather doubt it. I mean, if they haven't by now, that's the thing. And now you've got... WebKit, driving Safari, but also driving, all of the other people who are embedding that from Conqueror. I see that popping up in more and more open source software. My favorite microblogging client Gwibber uses WebKit. You've got Chrome now, and its open source counterpart Chromium. I mean, so maybe they will, but by the time IE9 comes out, you know, I saw some figure come out today saying that IE loses like 10% market share every 2 years. I'm not sure that that's right. That seems kind of
aggressive. I saw that article. Yeah.
Yeah.
Based on that, Firefox will overtake Internet Explorer by 2013, I think they said.
Really?
Can you imagine a world like that?
I'm just waiting for a world where we don't have to support Internet Explorer 6 anymore.
Yeah, that's the most evil thing in the world, Internet Explorer 6.
Yeah.
Because where I work, they set a threshold, I think, of 1%. For browser usage, and Internet Explorer 6, unfortunately, is still up above that 1% threshold that they have to continue to support, and it's just god-awful. Cause, you know,
don't you have to like put all these hacks in there, Dan, into your code, just for Internet Explorer 6, for web-based stuff?
The front-end guys do. I mean, to get something to work in Internet Explorer 6, 7, and 8 is just, it's atrocious. I mean, the developers are just ecstatic that to use Firefox and that, because that's hardly any problem. Even Opera's not a problem. Safari's usually not a problem, but it's always, that's all I ever hear coming from the front end. And a lot of our tickets are like that, too. Like, never do we have a ticket that says, well, this isn't working in Firefox or this isn't working in Opera, but we always get tickets like, it's this doesn't show up in Internet Explorer. And well, what version? Well, I think it's 6 or it could be 7, and it's just awful.
Well, it's worse than that, because any given vintage, like IE6, IE7, you've also got, I think 7 and probably 8 have gotten a little better with this regard, but I definitely remember this with 4 and 5 before 6, that the build number was critical. It wasn't just that you had a particular vintage of IE, but did you have a particular build? Then you got the whole DLL thing. So it's like, what particular version of a particular DLL do you have that might be affecting how ActiveX is behaving or how some other component is behaving? And that's nightmarish, man.
Yeah, it's when the 800-pound gorilla just doesn't give a damn. It just kills everybody. Of course, you could just design your sites with Internet Explorer in mind and don't have to worry about some of those things as much. Although I got out of the front-end stuff a couple of years ago, so right before IE7 hit, so I don't know.
I don't even think that's very realistic, though, because you want to do something that looks good. You want to do something that's complex and interesting and it does something effective. And so even if you're just targeting, say, IE7 or even IE8, you're going to get to a point where the documentation's inconsistent with how the browser actually works. You're going to run into all these quirks and weirdnesses that their engines had forever and ever. And, you know, with IE8, they were going to make a clean break, but, you know, then it turned out not really. And so I don't think that even saves you some grief. I think just if you have to touch it at all, it's like a, you know, it's like a tarball. You know, you're going to get it all over yourself no matter what you do.
That's a shame. Because I never hear anybody say, man, I just love Internet Explorer. It works so well. Never hear that. But yet, there are so many people that just don't know. And they use it every day.
Well, it's bundled, right? So what choice do they have? Even if they do have a choice, even if they could go get an uninstaller, even if they're marginally aware that there are other alternatives out there, it's right there on their desktop. It's the default browser after they install the OS, and, you know, who can be bothered? If they don't see firsthand the difference, and worse, so they're using it and everything's fine, and then it starts to flake out, They're just not aware enough to dig into the system and understand that it's not, you know, it could be other than what it is. They're like, this is just how it is.
Speaking of that, I'm curious. I have not bought a computer from, like, a big box store, like Staples or something. And, you know, needless to say, I haven't bought any system or installed Windows in a long time. Do they still bundle, like, AOL with computers anymore? I mean, is that still there? In MSN? Anybody? Guess nobody knows, huh?
No idea, man.
I'm just curious. God, is AOL even around anymore? I mean, I assume they are, but I never hear about them.
I think they are. A friend of mine still has an AOL email address.
Yeah. I remember back in the day when I used to do the front-end stuff, I used to get emails from people that say the site doesn't work on web TV. That's not around anymore, is it?
Sadly,
yeah,
I think it is.
I'm not totally sure about that one.
Whoa.
I had a friend that used to use that.
Web TV.
Is there 1% of web TV still out there? You know, that would be the question, it sounds like. So, you know, whether you'd have to support them. And maybe you can go poke your front-end developers. Go, hey, did you test that and make sure it's compatible with web TV?
Yeah, I think they'd slap me if I said that. They'd laugh me out of the cubicle.
I like this heathen X on the chat room. It says web TV equals Wii.
Yeah. Except
you can play decent games on a Wii, right?
Yeah, that runs Opera, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right.
And, that you know, Opera's not that bad. Although I don't run it. Yeah, I'm really interested in the WebKit stuff coming up. There's some really light, nice browsers, and like you say, Gwibber uses it, and what is that lightweight browser I think GNOME uses? It used to be called Galleon, that is switching over to WebKit. It used to be based on Firefox. Or, not Firefox, Gecko. What is that? It's not... Pat?
Begin with a D?
Not Dillo. You thinking of Dillo? Is that it, Dillo?
Dillo or something like that.
It's Dillo.
Epiphany, that's it.
Epiphany.
Yeah. Epiphany,
yeah. Close to a D.
Didn't that used to be Galleon? Or are they two different code bases?
Don't know.
Thomas, you should know, right?
Yes, hang on a second. Let me spool up my brain. I mean Wikipedia. I mean my brain.
maybe I'm wrong, because I remember I was using Galleon right... I think... was Galleon always based off of Firefox? No. Galleon came out around the same time that Firebird? Was that the original name of it, Firebird?
Was it Phoenix before it was Firebird?
Yeah, that's right,
yeah,
Phoenix.
It's Phoenix, yeah.
Phoenix, then Firebird, then Firefox, I think.
Because
mm-hmm. There was the whole thing about the Phoenix database or something. And I think Galleon
yeah.
was...
No, they're saying in the chat room that Galleon and Epiphany are, in fact, different.
Oh. But that's Dowdle saying it. I don't trust him. I want verification. No. Firebird database, yeah.
Citation needed.
See, I'm using Firefox over on this machine and Iceweasel on the other. That annoyed me. Because I installed Debian on this... this mezzo over here, and I'm like trying to install Thunderbird, but it's not Thunderbird, it's Ice Dove. And I didn't realize
they rebranded Thunderbird too. I had heard about Iceweasel, but I hadn't heard the alternate name for Thunderbird.
There's an alternate name for Thunderbird. There's an alternate name for I would assume there's an alternate name for what is it called?
Lightning and Sunbird.
Sunbird, that's it. I was thinking
the calendaring.
It's probably Frozenbird or something. I don't know.
Frozenbird.
Let me pull it up. It's got to be on here some. That's the thing, trying to find that. Like, what the heck? Good luck.
Well, yeah, because you can't go to Debian and search their package index looking for Sunbird, because it's not going to come up. And if you don't know the alternate name, then... No, I suppose you could go on looking for calendar.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing right now. Womp, womp,
womp. Fascinating radio. Listen to a handful of tech geeks search the web.
Yeah. Although, it's not listed in here. I don't know, what email client do you prefer?
Say again?
Gmail.
So you're all in the cloud with your email? Do you use it? Do you pull it down into a client, or you just stay in the web browser?
No, I stay in the browser. I used to. Pull it down through the IMAP. But I gotta say that the search and the labeling and, you know, the more stuff they pull in, it's pretty compelling.
Ah, it is called Ice Owl.
God. Like ice five times fast.
Yeah, there it is, Ice Owl. I tried looking under calendar, I couldn't find it. Standalone calendar application. So there's Ice Owl, there's Thunder, there's Ice Weasel, Ice Dove. Is there anything else? Well, Sea Monkey should still be branded Sea Monkey,
I think.
You don't know what Sea Monkey is?
Yeah, I know what Sea Monkey is.
Yeah.
I can't believe anybody's still using it, though.
Well, Slackware does. Maybe I should just look for ice. That's it, ice.
Ice pirates, that's good.
Yeah, I was thinking about that movie. Did you see the new Star Trek?
Yeah. Yeah, I took the kids to see it this past weekend.
Now, did you see it in a regular theater or IMAX?
Don't throw any spoilers there. I didn't see it yet.
I'm not going to.
No spoilers.
Did you see it in a regular theater or IMAX?
I saw it in a regular theater.
The guy who played Bones, McCoy?
Carl Urban.
He reminded me of Ben Urich, who was in Ice Pirates, if I'm not mistaken.
He was in Lord of the Rings, that guy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he was.
Now I have to go to my other internet brain, IMDb, and look up Ice Pirates.
If I'm not mistaken, was it Ben Urich who was the
captain?
Lead? Yeah. And Ice Pirates.
Is the guy from TV? What's his name? Robert Urich.
Urich. I'm sorry, Robert Urich.
That was a funny movie, though.
Monk was in that.
Was that the one with the rock eaters and the bar eaters? I forget.
No, that was the one with the space herpes.
Yeah.
That's right.
The what? What
now, I've heard they're not very dangerous. That's not what I've heard.
What were you talking about, Pat?
I forget. It was like a really cheesy, like, 80s space movie. And they had a character called the Rock Eater. This alien, they used to eat the rocks. And then they had, I forget what movie it was, God, but it was kind of like Ice Pirates. Same kind of style.
Be right back, guys.
Ice Pirates was awesome. Yeah, Ron Perlman was in that. I don't remember who he played, though.
Yeah, they've got the character name Zeno, but that's not ringing any bells. It's not helping. Great, now I'm going to have to rent it and watch it again.
Now, do you Netflix or do you go to a video store?
Oh, no, I've Netflixed for years.
Yeah. That's so nice. It is so much easier.
Yep. My original account was before they had the subscriptions. I actually dropped it when they went to the subscription model back in the day because I was skeptical. But, you know, then the local stores started closing up, so it's kind of like, you know, what choice do you have?
Follow in line. Yes. Do you
Terry Gilliam from the chat room. Gotta love Terry Gilliam. Time Bandits, Baron Munchausen, my all-time favorite film, Brazil.
Now, do you do Netflix streaming at all?
Yes. But I'm not entirely happy about their choice of technologies, obviously. But the experience is pretty compelling. I mean, I've read some people who have complained about it, but I just got fiber a few months back, and it's I got to tell you, it's really nice to you're in the mood to a movie for a movie. You find it as if it's you're lucky enough that it's a live stream to be able to get that instant gratification. And then I was rewatching an older film to talk on another podcast with some friends that wanted to do a review of it. I had gotten about halfway through the film and I had to leave. And I came back expecting I'd have to start all over again, that it would be, you know, kind of that stupid. And I was pleasantly surprised that Netflix actually had some sort of bookmark capability that when it buffered up to the point where I was last playing that particular film. It's really nice.
What are you using to, are you using Windows to stream Netflix? Or
no, I guess I'm all Mac in the household, but they're all Intel Macs, and so they're using Mono. They must be using Moon something, or maybe there actually is a Silverlight built for the Intel-based Macs. So I try not to think about it because it would make me feel dirty.
Now, you know what I was just thinking about here, because tonight, because of your podcast, I will be starting Hackers.
What a wonderfully bad movie.
No, actually, I'm talking about the book.
Levy's book.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the one with Johnny Lee Miller.
No, I'll have to Netflix that now, though. I haven't seen that in a long time, but I was talking about
that was
book.
A bad movie.
That was a bad movie.
And the Net, another one. What was the one? Antitrust.
Yeah, the one with Miguel DeCosta and Mad Dog Hall in it for like 2 seconds.
Uh-huh. And the Pirates of Silicon Valley. Did you own an Apple growing up?
No.
Thomas? No?
Good man.
No, like I said. We had dumb terminals hooked up to a mini, and then the first personal computer we had was a Leading Edge Model D.
Was that one of those that ran its own version of BASIC or something?
Yeah, I think it came bundled with a one-off version of BASIC, but it was DOS. I can't remember if it was monochrome. I can't remember if it was the amber or it was the green, though.
So you didn't do the Commodore 64 or TI-99/4A or any of those? VIC-20?
Oh, my friends were hacking on those. I was sitting in front of a dumb terminal. I was playing Adventurer and Telengard and whatever else we could find in the games package that came with AOS VS, which was the operating system on the DG Minis.
Was that version of Adventure, was that the same one that Scott Adams did?
One with the big green snake and the Zizzy?
No.
I want to say that it is. No?
Well, I'm thinking of the one of the text adventure, Scott Adams adventure game.
Yeah, this was a text adventure. It was
big green snake.
Yeah, there was a valley with a big green snake, and you had to get the bird cage and let the bird out, and the bird would drive the snake off, and you could get through the valley.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah, that's right. Now I remember. It's been so long.
I love that game.
Yeah, I used to play a lot of Scott Adams adventure games. They were awesome. I guess you could still play them today with emulators. In fact, I believe people have put them out on the web, haven't they? You just play them right off the web.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt it in the slightest.
Now, aside from board games, are you do you play a lot of video games? Or do you play any video games?
Not as much as I used to. I was definitely a teenager of the 8-bit and the 16-bit era, so I had a Sega Master System. I had a Genesis that I wore out, and I got a Sega CDX, which was the 16-bit console, and the CD drive all in one. I got a Saturn. Actually, my wife bought me a Saturn when that came out, and I wept huge, big crocodile tears when the Dreamcast stopped production. And so we've had a console as a consequence in our house ever since. I mean, my two boys pretty much wore out. We had an Xbox. I got it as a gift, and there were a variety of games that they really enjoyed on that, and they wore that thing out. And so now we've got a Wii, and we try to target things that we can kind of all do, like Boom Blocks or Wii Sports. And it's tough to find time. I got the last game I got for myself. Actually, the second to last game I got for myself was Resident Evil 4, and I still haven't finished it, because it's nobody else wants to be around when I'm playing it. You know, the kids really shouldn't, and my wife is hugely afraid of zombies. And then actually the most recent game I got was the Lego Batman. I love all the Lego games.
The Resident Evil 4 on the Wii is amazing. I love that
game.
Yeah. I played it on the GameCube too, and the Wii with the remote is just awesome. But the Lego series games are a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's before we retired the Xbox. That's pretty much what the boys were playing exclusively, and it's kind of funny. It's like a brute force algorithm in practice, because they'll just, you know, I'll get to a point where I'm like, that's it. I've played through everything. I don't really feel like unlocking every last power up and power brick and whatever. And they'll just play and play and play and play and play and replay until they've just randomly gone through every last thing, or they've just accrued enough hours on it to brute force and unlock everything. So they did that. I had the two separate games on the Xbox, because they came out, each trilogy came out separately. And then when we retired that, we absolutely had to get the Wii version, which is all six movies all together with the additional enhancements and secret doodads in it. And they're doing that too. And then what surprises me is that they're doing that brute force right now on Super Smash Brothers. You know, so they're unlocking like all of the characters, and you know they're not terrifically good at it. They're button mashers definitely. They're not finesse players, but just that determination. Fact that, you know, once their homework's done or it's on a weekend, you know, they've got plenty of free time. They just go at it like you wouldn't believe. You know, it's like we have to limit, because if we allowed them, if we just gave them their lead, they'd turn into spherical blobs with Wiimotes attached to them.
Oh, I know how that goes. I'm at 99% on the Lego Star Wars and close to 99% on the Indiana Jones, but I don't have the Batman one yet.
You got to get Batman. Batman's fantastic. That was I was out of work for a couple of months at the end of last year, and that was my brass ring to shoot for. When I got an offer that I was willing to accept, I was going to hold off, because the game came out like right at that time. And I was like, you know what, this is going to be my treat for myself. So if I'm good, if I'm diligent, so I'm out beating the bushes, I'm working. And this was right before the downturn. I lost my job right before the downturn, so I'm sitting here going, oh my god, you know, the bottom's falling out, the market's horrible, what am I going to do? So this is one of the things I used to kind of help incent myself through that. And I tell you, that was the sweetest weekend. You know, I had the offer, I signed the offer, turned it in, I went out to the GameStop right after I faxed off the offer, picked that up, and then plunked down for like 48 hours straight and just played that. And so there's that. But, I mean, the game in and of itself is just so much fun. They squeeze so much in there that you wouldn't think that they could have squeezed in there. And the gameplay is, it's like, oh, Star Wars, you know, it's the same thing all over again. They've managed to find something that stands up and is a little bit different.
That's cool. Because I know the other two games were hilarious. I mean, there was just so much inside humor in there if you were a fan of the movies and had seen them all. It's just little stuff. They put more personality in that Star Wars game in one chapter than in the entire series that George Lucas put together.
The dialogue was probably better, too.
Yeah. I mean, it was just... They didn't even need dialogue.
It was written there, I'm sure.
There was no words. They just had expressions on their faces, and it's just so awesome.
There you go.
Yeah, I was... another thing I was pleasantly surprised at with the Lego Indiana Jones was the version for the Wii was different than the version that came out on the DS. And that was... They could have just, you know, dumbed down the version for the DS, but they made it was a different game on the DS, and it was pretty cool. Do you have a DS, Thomas?
I had one. I gave it up, so I'm saving up for a DSi right now. When I got my DS, I got it at the same time I got my older son his DS, and then we got a used GBA for my younger son because he was at that age where giving him a brand new, fresh out of the box electronic just didn't feel like a good idea. Like this was going to end up, you know, left out in the yard, out in the rain, or something like that. And that turned out to be justified. But when he turned, or this past Christmas, you know, he had been so pestering his older brother and so drawn to the DS, and he seemed to be responsible enough that I gave up mine and gave him my old DS as a Christmas present. So the two of them now are just like, any given Saturday afternoon, they're downstairs in the playroom, hunched over head to head, whether they're on the wireless playing each other or not. So, you know, they're almost like playing, and then peripherally they're watching the other one play. And I haven't gotten around to replacing it yet.
Yeah, how old's your youngest?
He's six. He's going to be seven in just a little over a month.
Yeah, we have gone through too many DSs in this household, largely because people have gotten them stolen. Mm. But I was bummed, man, because I had one, and I took such good care of it, and the case itself just... The hinge cracked one day, and I had to go and buy a replacement case, and that was a nightmare to put together. And now, out of all the DSs we've had, there's only one left over, and we all have to use that one. That's the one that works the best, the new one. So we learned how to share, and there's fights.
Now, we've gone through our share of chargers and Stellite, but not... thankfully, we haven't had to replace a DS yet. I mean, the six-year-old lost his GBA, and then I've got one of the ones that they where they put the skin on it that looks like the old Game Boy. That's the GBA that I've got. So he was playing mine for a little while, and I was cringing the whole time, just waiting for him to break it or lose it. And then, like about a month or two later, he actually turned up his GBA. Kind of surprised us. You know, he just like left it in the backseat of the car or something, and managed to dig it out.
Yeah, what's kind of a bummer about the DSi is they've taken out the GBA slot.
Well, I still have an old GBA, so I'm not too bummed about that. But I see what you mean.
I am.
You know, if yours. Especially if you're on that treadmill, like, you know, I go up to the GameStop, and I see these 12-year-olds in there, and they're like, I don't know, they're like addicts. They're like, what do you give me for these? I got 10 or 15 used games. You know, can I get a PSP or a PS3 for that? What, you only give me $20? Okay, let me get something. You know, it seems like a bit of a racket, but I guess, you know, it's better than the alternative. You know, they're not throwing them away.
Yeah. Some of those you can get a nice little penny for. Like, I was surprised. I forget what game I took back. It was an original Game Boy game. And they were like, this is probably only going to give you like a buck or two. But it turned out that it gave me like, I think it was $5 or $10 credit for an original Game Boy. The brick one. Do you have one of those? That big green, that big white brick with the green screen.
No, but my wife.
Black and white version.
And it had like a an hour and a half, 2 hour battery life or something. I remember my uncle complaining about that. He was my uncle was really big
virtual
into computers.
Boy.
And and he was Alan, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
Oh, okay. My uncle was big into computers when I was growing up with the Atari series computers, the Atari computer. But he had a Game Boy, and his biggest complaint when he got it was there was no way you could beat Castlevania on it because the battery would run out before the game ended. So you had to buy the adapter to plug it into the wall, and then it wasn't portable. I'll tell you what, these kids these days, they got it easy. I remember back in the day when we didn't have save features, and if you wanted to save something, you had to enter in, like, some 16-digit code.
No kidding. We got the original Sonic on the Wii Shop, you know, the download, and it's great. I'm playing it, and I'm like, oh, this is just, like, it takes me all the way back to playing this on my Genesis. This is awesome. And then go back to the main
menu. My 5-year-old's been playing Sonic stuff. I got the ROM images running on DGen emulator.
Mm-hmm.
I got the whole series, and he loves it.
Yeah, mine do too. They really it's so funny. It's gone beyond the game. It's like they recognize this is something I grew up with, so they always want to show me like the latest version of Sonic, and I'm like, I can't watch that. It makes my brain hurt to watch Sonic pull a fourth dimensional U-turn. All this crazy stuff that he can do on these new consoles. I'm like, just give me the parallax side scroller. But it goes beyond that. We went up to Beyond Comics, our little shop here in the area, for free comic book day. All the boys wanted to get Sonic comics. It's all they were interested in. I'm like, you know, here's the full sampler, here's the DC, here's all this indies, and they're like, no, we want Sonic. I'm like, okay, cool.
That's one of the things that's nice about the virtual console there is you could just, like, stop the game anywhere.
That's what I was getting to. That's what floored me. I went to show my wife because she was a fan of Sonic when she was that age as well. And I'm like, hey, you got to see this. And I started back on it. I'm like, what the? I can save this now? Oh, I wish I had a time machine. I could take my Wii back to my young self and go, here, don't stay up 72 hours straight trying to finish Sonic 2. Here you go.
Yeah, that is awesome. Were you a Mega Man fan?
No, I didn't. I wasn't. It wasn't that I was against it or anything. I just didn't really play it. Didn't own it.
Because you were into the 8-bit and 16-bit games. So, have you gotten Mega Man 9 on the Wii yet? Through the Wii?
No, not yet.
I think it is. You should really get that when you get around to it. It is a phenomenal game. I mean, they just hit all the right marks for an 8-bit game. It's brand new, and Capcom just decided instead of making a new Fandango Mega Man, they were going to go back to the old school. And I think it's an 8-bit Mega Man game, and it's just so awesome. It takes you right back to the music. They even had the program in glitches to slow it down a little bit and cause that same effect where the screen would get jittery.
Did you see that article about those grad students that were trying to reintroduce into the emulators the quirks of old tube sets? And I guess the theory going that the Atari 2600 programmers and like that vintage and some slightly forward of that actually were taking advantage of like some of the fuzzing and some of the quirks that would happen with the tube set to try to make the game actually look better on a crappier display than, like, if you run it under an emulator on an LCD.
Huh. No, I didn't, but I could see them actually doing that. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I just thought that was crazy. I mean, it made perfect sense when they described it. It's like, and then the cool thing is, like, the version of the article that I saw had a screenshot where they had a split screen side by side, so they had, like, the screen straight off the emulator, and then they had the right hand side of the screen was with the filters and the hate to call them enhancements because they're actually degrading the display, but you could actually totally see the point because it would soften off. It would act like these systems weren't able to do any kind of anti-aliasing, but effectively that's kind of what some of it looked like.
That is awesome. Yeah, that is cool when they do stuff like that. Now, do you play around with a lot of emulators?
Not recently. There was a period where I was playing with them before the ROM site started getting taken down back in the late 90s. So there were some cabinet games that, like Sinistar, which came up in the chat room, had to grab a copy of that ROM. Looked at some of the console emulators, but again, it boils down to, you know, so many other interesting things to do that just not enough time to do that, too.
So what's your biggest time waster now? I won't say time waster, time taker now, aside from work and family. I mean, you said that you were working on a couple open source projects.
Surprisingly enough, the open source projects don't take a lot of time. Like Flashbake, I would say half of that code base was written during my commute. Even though my sense is there's a fair number of users, they're not very demanding. They're pretty happy with it. There's only a couple of features that people are kind of pushing for, but they're being very patient. So, you know, that one's nice because I can pick it up and I can work on it, or I can put it down and do something else for a while and there's nobody kind of breathing down my neck. I mean, I think unless you're like one of the really big, very popular open source or free software projects, that's very much the case. Actually it's been the podcast because I'm putting that out twice a week, because I'm, you know, I do a lot of writing to prepare for that. I've built over the past 4 years, piece by piece, I've upgraded and built to the point where I've refurbished a room in my home into a home office / studio, to make it comfortable for spending so much time in here. So I would say that's far and away, after, as you say, day job and family, number one time sink.
What is Flashbake?
It's kind of hard to describe, and every time I do, people kind of misunderstand it. But let me back up and maybe tell a bit of a story, and maybe that'll help explain it a little bit better. Cory Doctorow emailed me back in like late January, early February, and said, "Hey, I'm looking to use source control for my writing projects. What do you recommend?" And he described a little bit else about what it is that he was looking to do with it. He wanted to be able to share some of his repository with his editor so they could go over typos and the like. And I had just done a segment on distributed version control, so looking at VZR and Git. And so I recommended Git to him because I felt it had a little bit more momentum. This was just my impression at that time. Had maybe a slightly better choice of tools, more people kind of actively working on tooling for it, and said, you know, with a distributed version control system like this, you don't have to be online, because I knew he traveled a lot, and so having to be on the network all the time in order to commit into this repository was going to be problematic. And the fact that Git and BZR does very much the same thing, and I think Mercurial does the same thing as well, it's so easy to clone out your repository for purposes of sharing. And if you're doing more than sharing, if you're actually using it for code development, it makes it so easy to merge back in and pull selective revisions and stuff like that. So I said, why not, you know, Git's got a lot of mind share. It seems to have some good tools. You know, I think that'd be a pretty good fit. He says, great. Now, how do I use it? And I'm like, okay. You know, he kind of got the basics, but I think that the workflow is, you know, if you write code, or even if you're a sysadmin and you're doing a lot of configuration management, so you get to natural checkpoints where you're going to commit stuff in with a descriptive comment that you made a change for a particular purpose to address a particular bug, what have you. This makes sense to people who are working with large text files, source or config files, that kinds of stuff. You know, you're hacking on your build process, whatever. To a writer who maybe works a little bit more organically and is thinking like state of mind, like what was I doing on a particular day? What was I thinking of on a particular day? I don't think they think of that in terms of kind of crystallizing that and snapshotting that in with the state of their work. So we kind of went back and forth in the correspondence on this, and he said, you know, he described that to me, that he really wanted some way to kind of seamlessly capture his state of mind, and he offered up, you know, capturing like the time zone off of his system to give a rough sense of where in the world he was located, the uptime on his system, because he's a geek, and who doesn't like to brag about the continuous uptime on their box. He wanted the weather based on, so his time zone he was tracking like Ubuntu does by default as an ISO code, so you actually got a city name in there. So weather based on that city name. And then because Corey uses Boing Boing as kind of a file of things interest to him that he might want to return back to in his research and his writing, the last couple of stories with his byline on Boing Boing. And he wanted that, you know, with each commit to be kind of his state of mind. And we talked about beyond that some ways to automate the commit process. We initially wanted to look at maybe writing like a gedit plugin or something like that. But we wanted to get something spun up a little bit faster. So this started as kind of some shell scripts and a little bit of Python. The Python more to kind of pull together his life stream and the shell scripts more to kind of drive the Git automation. And then even the shell scripting got a little too complex, so it all kind of folded into what became Flashbig, that after 19 releases to him and just him, he said, hey, do you want to share this with everybody else? And I was like, okay, not really thinking about it. And he posted it on Boing Boing, and he's talked about it a couple of other times, and every time he does, my VPS provider screams and yells at me. Not really. I mean, my VM just dies, but... so I don't know if that kind of gives a sense that it's partly an automation tool, and I'm really trying to get my head above water on it to the point where I can explore other ways of automating the version control. Right now it's kind of, you know, it's a cron job with a quiet period, like borrowing from stuff like Hudson and Cruise Control, where it's just kind of like, you know, rather than committing every 5 minutes, it's wake up every 5 minutes, see if things have stabilized long enough so there hasn't been any changes within this quiet period. That means that chances are that he's not actively working in a file, and only commit when things have been quiet for a sustained amount of time. But that's still kind of crude, and that's been one of the criticism / feedbacks I've gotten on it is, you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense with version control to commit every 5 minutes. And it's like, well, if you understand how version control works, it's only going to commit what's going to change, number one. Number two, storage is cheap. And number three, if you're comparing versions, and these are all arguments that I didn't even have to come up with, that people came up with who are interested in the project kind of on my behalf to kind of defend it, but that, you know, if you're comparing particular versions, who cares how many versions are in between? You do a diff between any arbitrary points in time, and the tool's going to do an adequate job of netting it down to exactly what's different between, it doesn't matter how distant those two versions are from each other, the diff's just going to deal with those two. But I do feel that we can go beyond that. I want to look at the Fuse project and see if there's some things we can do there to push it down to, if it makes sense to push it down to the level of a file system. So you could do something with, maybe it's with a quiet period or some other heuristic to determine. So you're not generating too much chatter into your version control system, but something that's a lot more seamless and intelligent than a cron job, or maybe even going back to revisiting a gedit plugin or a variety of plugins for other systems. But that's kind of where it's at. In the offing, we just released version 0.25. I've had I've been very fortunate to have a couple of other people contribute in some fixes and some plugins for that along the way. We now have a smart location module that uses a free IP location database online. So rather than having to use the time zone code to try to figure out where you are, I actually do, the plugin for that does it hits noreply.org to get your public IP address, and then tries to resolve that down to a location. And there's Scrivener support because there's a fair number of Mac users, and apparently I guess a lot of writers on the Mac really rave about Scrivener. So one of my contributors actually is a Scrivener user, and so he wrote a pretty powerful Scrivener plugin for that. But we're looking at next, I think, I'm going to start digging into Twisted, which is a Python kind of embedded web server, just because that's kind of the GUI I know how to build as a web application, to do a history viewer that's similar, that kind of nets the Git history down to something that a writer or creative would be interested in, rather than giving the full view like a lot of the the tools that are out there for viewing and interacting with history in Git are really targeted at developers. Like I said, guys who are familiar with working with these very deep histories and doing branches and merge and all these other things that are maybe not as necessary to the process of writing.
Yeah, I do believe I recall Cory Doctorow talking about Flashbake. And sounds like a very, very interesting and well worth project. Was there another project that you were working on?
I wrote a plugin for WordPress to better integrate with Laconica. There was kind of a very simple plugin by an outfit, I think it was an ISP called Blue Fur, that wasn't very capable, so I forked to their code. And so I'm on the client or the tools page up at the control yourself track instance for Laconica. And so that just it does, it's very basic, but I've got a list of about a half a dozen features I keep meaning to get to. A small user base gives me some pretty good feedback, so that lets me do some PHP hacking and a little bit of WordPress hacking.
That's cool. That's awesome. Oh, I'm sorry, dear. I'm trying to think. Dave Yates, are you still on? Pat, are you still on?
I'm still on.
But Dave Yates isn't. Because I know Dave Yates was saying he was trying to say something before, but I think his audio died. Your show that you do twice a week is very solid, very packed with information. How much preparation do you actually put into each show, would you say?
A lot. Most of it. I would say for the feature cast, that's, I mean, in that instance, it's a little bit easier because the various segments that I do for the Wednesday show are drawing from my own experiences or conversations or things that I'm thinking about. But I do try to write those out ahead of time. So that I'm not stumbling for something to say. I just outline them, and I actually release the outlines along with the show on my website, put them out in PDF and OPML version under the same CC license I release the audio under. So that's maybe an hour and a half of writing. It's maybe a couple of days of kind of thinking about it, kind of pulling my thoughts together. I actually have a personal wiki that I've been able to leverage to get a couple of weeks ahead in my writing, which is kind of a nice feeling. The news show takes quite a bit more time. I'm pretty much continuously trolling through hundreds of items from various RSS feeds during the course of the week and bookmarking them and flagging them out. And then I'll sit down over the course of maybe an hour on Saturday, maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours on Sunday, read through those, either mark them up briefly to put them in the weekend review post that I also put up Sundays on my website, or to try to write out about 5 to 6 minutes worth of discussion on them. But I find that the trick is, especially since I kind of have to balance this with the day job and with the family, is having that consistent schedule. Being able to set the expectation that, you know, on a Saturday I need to carve out an hour. So, you know, if the kids want to do something, then they have to be patient while I do that. Then we can go off, we can go watch a movie together. Same thing on the weeknights. I try to work it around their quiet reading time because they're at an age where they have to do continuous reading as part of their schoolwork. So I try to find ways to do those parts of it, kind of fit them naturally into the pauses in everybody else's schedule. But yeah, it is a rather bit of time. I think the fact that I've been doing it almost 4 years helps. You know, I kind of have some muscle memory built up. It's a continuous practice. So when I sit down, I'm not just kind of staring at a blank outline thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? You know, I've done this several hundred times before, and that helps a lot. And then in some ways, too, even being able to start, you know, as my audience has grown, and now that we have all these crazy cool little tools like Identica and Twitter, to be able to throw questions out to my audience, to my friends, to people who are interested, you know, put questions out there. I've gotten some good show suggestions that way, where people have asked me questions and asked me to address them on the show, or actually dedicate a segment to talk about something in depth. So there are some nice ways to kind of help cut down on that a little bit, or borrow some momentum from other people from time to time.
Awesome. I mean, you
I'm here now, Dan.
Thank you, Dave. You could tell you put a lot of work into the show because, I mean, it's solid and very, very informative. But go ahead, Dave Yates, if you had any questions or comments that you wanted to bring up since your audio died.
Well, they're all, like, off topic now. I was going to mention Mega Man 9 earlier, and you mentioned it the same time I did. Just talking about how I just think that game's incredibly hard. I can't play it.
Mm-hmm. That's because you're kind of old, Dave.
Yeah, kind of.
I get the younger reflexes going. But, yeah, it's a great game.
Damn,
I highly recommend
you.
That's right. Alan, you have like a bunch of my old consoles and games and stuff. Do you ever play them, or do you just have them for historical purposes?
Right now they're all in the basement because I don't have anything to play them on right now in terms of TV, but I'm too lazy to take apart the TV in the living room to hook up the connectors for them anymore. But yeah, they're all still downstairs. I cleaned them up. Made them look all nice. But I haven't played them, unfortunately.
Awesome. Good for you, Alan. That's the most we ever hear out of Alan. In
yeah.
4 weeks. Did Joel ever make it on?
Weeks.
Gorkon? No?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Holy mackerel. You are loud.
I got to unmute. Oh, let me turn now.
All right.
Better?
Well, hold on. Hold on a second, Joel, before you go shooting your mouth off with whatever you want to say. What I wanted to thank you, Thomas, for coming on and enlightening us with all your stuff. You're more than welcome to stay. We're probably going to move on to a few other topics. So if you'd like to stay on, that's great. I really, really enjoy your podcast. You do a phenomenal job, and your blog and everything. Keep up the great work, and I recommend everybody to go over to the commandline.net and check out what you have there. Good stuff.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
No problem. But,
I do have a family, and I've got another interview tomorrow. My voice is starting to go a little bit, so I think I probably will bow out.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, and you have a great week.
Yeah, thanks for being on.
You too. Yeah.
Take it easy. Thank you, Joel. We'll talk to you next week, too. Joel, go ahead and talk about what you wanted to talk about, if you had something to talk about, because I got to go do something, but I'll be listening.
Well, you go do your something. Actually, I was going to say, Pat, go ahead and talk about Ubuntu 1.
Canonical has started a new service in beta called Ubuntu 1, and basically it's like Dropbox, except from them. You can have a folder on your system, and you could share it out to other people. Other people can share out their folders to you by invite only. If you have 2 gig of storage, the service is free. Otherwise, they charge, I think, $10 a month for 10 gig of storage. And again, this is in beta, so supposedly they're going to roll out some other services besides this that are related to it. There is a desktop client that's only for Ubuntu right now. I've got that installed, and I've been playing around with it. I've been doing some testing with Claudio, who's in the IRC, and it works pretty well. You know, basically what you do is you have a folder, you set it up in Ubuntu 1, you put some files in there. You say, I want to share this out. You put the email address of the person you want to send it to. They'll get the email. They have to be registered with Ubuntu 1 to be able to share the files. So both ends have to have it for it to work. Now, you can use it, I think, with other OSs and other distributions, with the web client, it'll work with that as well. So right now the actual user client is on Ubuntu only. Supposedly they're going to roll it out to other distros, which is kind of cool.
Well, you know what? I don't use Dropbox. I have a vague idea of how Dropbox works, and I sure as heck haven't really looked into Ubuntu One. I mean, what does this do? What does the client do, and what does the web client do, or not do?
They do the same thing. Okay. The only difference is the web client opens up in your web browser. Okay, and you can copy files back and forth through there.
Is that just like a file transfer? Or is that done through Ajax?
I'm not sure. It is Python based. And the client is open source. It's released under the GPL. But I believe the server is closed source, and they're going to keep it closed for the future. So I guess, you know, they're looking to make some money off of this.
So the web-based thing that you said, is that strictly web-based and it'll run on any platform, or is it you have to install a client portion to access the web stuff?
I think you can pull it down. I'm not sure, actually. I was able to copy up a file through the web. Not sure about pulling down.
Ah, so it's one-way transfer.
Do you like it better than Dropbox, Pat?
It's nice, you know. And it's the fact that it's coming from Canonical is kind of cool.
Yeah. You got any invites? You know who has I'm on a waiting list.
I got in. I've been in there. Stefano Forenzo, who's on the Linux Planet blogs, he put together a very good post about it, if you want to go read it.
Hmm.
You can check it out at linuxplanet.org blogs.
And do you have an invite for Dave Gates?
I think you can just go to the website. I posted the URL. It's ubuntu1.com. You should be able to register in there. And I don't know how long it's going to take for you to actually get in there.
I did this yesterday,
and like as soon as I heard about it, I think it was Ken Van Dyne mentioned it on Denica, and like I was on the waiting list for maybe, I don't know, an hour, and then I actually got the invite after that. So your mileage may vary depending on how many people are queuing up to get in there. But it seems pretty cool.
I use Dropbox occasionally.
It's a convenient thing. You know?
I use it all the time. I love Dropbox. But I've definitely checked this out.
I think that
it's a quick and easy way to do it without having to, like, you know, worry about popping holes through your firewall and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so, you know, once you get some people that you know that are on there, definitely, you know, go at it. If you encounter problems, you know, definitely submit some bugs to them. Let them know.
Well, I can always use another 2 gigs of space out in the cloud for the free one.
Yeah, I could see its use, you know. There's certain files that you want to share across your machines. Including outside of the local network.
It's kind of what I do with Dropbox. When I'm writing a review or something and I want to have the pictures on any of the machines that I'm using, I basically will synchronize them across all those machines. And 2 gigs, that's a lot of pictures. You know, so it's not all, you know, my family pictures wouldn't fit in that, but for a review, yeah.
What do you got now, Sassy?
So,
shut your mouth.
who's Sassy?
I think that's Gorkon's dog.
Gorkon.
Yeah.
Look, before we get too far into things here, I want to go back to my apology, because I just wasn't throwing an apology out like Dave Yates would do, right, Dave? No. what I started going off on, and hopefully you can still hear me, is I wanted to apologize. Is that all I said was an apology? Did I explain, did I even go into why I was apologizing?
You know, you didn't. You haven't talked about it.
Oh, all right.
You said, well, I'd like to apologize, and you disappeared.
Yes, well, okay. Last week, the streaming server got cracked. Well, I mean, I found out the streaming server was cracked. And I had written a blog posting about it entitled, "The Crackers Came a Knockin', Webmin Let 'Em In." And I received some feedback, comments about that. And one of the things that stood out, two things stood out. One was, you know, well, why didn't you secure Webmin, or you're using the latest version? Because Webmin is, you know, pretty up on security. And so it's not the fault of, you know, Webmin. And two was, why are you even using Webmin? You should be using SSH. Well, first off, number one, if you read the third sentence in my blog posting, I do not blame Webmin for this. This is entirely my fault, unequivocally my fault, my mistake. I should have secured it properly. And number two, the reasoning behind using or installing Webmin to begin with resulted from a few months back having issues with getting into the server, because it is the Colo VMS server that I usually SSH into to fix, and I was having problems with SSHing into it, that I'd have to contact their support to see, you know, to reboot it for me and find out what's going on. And I thought, you know, if I can have another way to access this machine, some other interface, aside from paying for their Plesk or whatever it was service that they provide, it would be nice to have that. So I had thrown Webmin on there in the process, and I think I had pulled it down or used the version that they were offering or something. I can't remember what it was. And right after I had gotten it on there, they had, their tech support had provided me with an easy URL backdoor type thing that I could reboot the machine with. So I got lazy, and I was in the middle of doing a few other things and forgot I even had to configure Webmin on that. And lo and behold, next thing I know, somebody cracked it, which was, like I said, completely my fault, because I never took the time to set it up properly, configure it, and secure it, which...
Is that why I get all that spam from you, Dan?
No. No. The spam you get, the spam from us, the spam
I'm joking,
get,
I'm kidding around.
Is because my email account is like 8 years old, and my domain is like 8 years old, so it's...
been harvested to no end.
Yeah, so it's in there. So, downside about it being cracked was, well, aside from being cracked, it was also the Laconica server. And unfortunately, even though when I pulled the stuff down to maybe preserve some of the information, it just wasn't going to happen when I reestablished. I wiped out the server right away, reinstalled Debian on there. It's all up to date, all patched. I couldn't get the Laconica stuff back on there the way I wanted to, so it's just a brand new install of Laconica, unfortunately. The damage for that had already been done, you know, and that sucks. And I apologize to the people who had accounts on there. It was my mistake and my shoddy workmanship that caused that, or lack of workmanship and crafting and security. But, you know, I learned my lesson, and it won't happen again. Anyway... I don't want anybody to go away thinking that Webmin is an insecure tool, because honestly, they do a damn good job with securing it, and it's only as secure as the administrator. And at this point, the administrator was horribly insecure. So, nothing against Webmin, and I never wanted to imply that at all.
You're forgiven.
Thank you, Alan. That means a lot.
Dave couldn't have said it better.
Which means if you were like subscribed to me on the Laconica there, on it, resubscribe, because I lost everything. For the one post I put a week on that one. Actually, my Mythbox posts more than I do. But
what was that, Alan? I'm sorry.
No, I just said if anybody was subscribed to me to resubscribe, because I don't think I got all my subscriptions that I was getting before. So resubscribe.
So what else, peoples?
I already got some requests.
I got
to, go ahead, Gorkon.
Oh, no. If you go ahead, Pat.
I was just going to say that I already got requests for to make the MIT TV cast an MP3 feed and an iTunes feed.
No surprise there.
Yeah, not getting either one of those. but people are free to do so if they want to.
So no MP3 feed?
No.
No iTunes feed?
No iTunes feed, no. Not on my watch.
He's lazy.
Exactly.
And wants to support open source too, so.
Yeah, it's a win-win.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got this new webcam/microphone that I'm using this week, although I don't have the webcam on. It's from Blue Microphone. It's the Eyeball webcam. It's pretty nice. Good Linux support, too.
Was that, does that work with Linux?
Yeah.
Out of the box?
Yep. No
cheese
configuration whatsoever. Plug it in, it works. Huh?
Cheese and flash?
Cheese, yes, flash. I've tried to get it to work with Yahoo or YouTube, but I've had problems with YouTube before. I'll have to try it with Stickcam. But it's kind of handy. It has the...
Sounds good, Alan.
Yeah.
Excellent audio quality, man. Yeah, good.
So. I like it. It's good. It's a good cam.
How much was it?
It's a good question. I don't know. I got this one in on for review for Gear Diary. Let me do a quick Google. It's the Blue Eyeball. I kind of like the way it looks. It's got the webcam kind of pops out of the side of the microphone. It's more of a microphone than it is a webcam, but it does both real well.
So you got this to review for Gear Diary, so you didn't pay a dime for it, you're saying?
Yes.
Ah, the truth comes out.
I didn't. Nope. But I will get a price here. Looks similar, by the way, it looks similar to the Snowflake. Have you ever seen that microphone?
No.
Yeah. It is... Let me see if it comes up here. Amazon's slow. $86.50. Kind of expensive.
Holy mackerel. But at least it works with Linux.
And it's gorgeous, too. It's the stand's all made out of metal. It can hang on your monitor or off of your... you can probably put it like on your desk or something if you wanted to. It probably work well in either of those kind of situations. The mic's only a mono microphone, but that's okay.
So you're not going to self, are you?
No, no plans to go. I'd love to, but no money, and my wife would kill me.
Is Dave Yates still on?
I am on.
Any self news?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Any self news? Hear you just
fine. Yeah, we have picked our keynote speakers, and we have settled on all but two of the rest of the speakers. They should be on the website soon. Am I still there?
You still there?
Yes.
Okay. I've had nothing but audio problems tonight. Joe Zonker, Brockenmeyer, and Paul Frields are going to be the keynote speakers. That's, I guess that's the biggest news. We're just about settled up on our expo floor area, picking out who's going to be there. And the biggest hurdle I just got over recently was somebody told me that it was going to require a parking permit to park on campus anywhere near the Student Hendricks Center. But I found out today that we've got we're part of the summer conference program at the university, which means you can park anywhere as long as it's not on the grass. As long as it's a visitor, employee, or student parking place, you can park on campus if you're attending sales. So we dodged that bullet. That was going to be a nightmare scenario. But we got a lot left
singing
to do. We're on the
sounds like sounds like we got someone that's trying out for American Idol.
That's at the Gorkon household.
I won't ask.
I should say the Gorkon.
Yeah,
the Gorkon cardboard box. Dave, is there any truth to the rumor that the event is going to be catered by KFC grilled chicken?
No, none. None whatsoever. Because this is a first-year conference, we don't have it in our budget to feed anybody except at the, anything. But if you're a paid supporter, you'll get a couple of free drinks on Friday and again on Saturday, pre-party, after-party. But that's it as far as food goes. There are 3 to 5 restaurants on the bottom floor of the Student Hendricks Center. So lunch is a buy-your-own kind of proposition. But no rumor to that. No truth to that rumor, I should say. We picked up
a
couple of new sponsors today. So, yeah, me neither. But, things have come along real good. We had a pessimistic budget that we're just going to reach, I think. We have pessimistic ideal and a optimal budget target, and I really had my doubts if we were going to meet even the pessimistic, but we did. So things are looking good.
What the hell is that?
Is that
Alan?
I think
that's Alan. What the hell is that, man?
I had my mic unplugged.
Bring out your dead.
Oops.
That's Gork. That's Gorkon again.
Like somebody screwing their microphone in.
What the hell's going on?
Dave, two things.
The eyeball microphone? Yes. Yes.
Hold on.
Oh, my God. What? Holy.
I'll wait until the
beat. He's ruining the show.
Finishes flying over Gorkon's house. Box. Yes. I stand corrected. Box. I did two things. One, first off, my wife says hello. And secondly, do me a favor. Please do not give me or make me in charge of the drink tickets, because I do a horrible job with that, and I drink more tickets than I should.
You were the first person I thought of, Dan.
No, that's not a good idea.
But it's just so fun to watch.
It might be fun to watch.
It is fun to watch.
It's not fun to deal with. No, it's a bad idea.
Dan will show up at the table at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon again.
So a ticket for you and a ticket for me.
I thought that was Gorkon who did that.
Pat, you're...
No, Gorkon doesn't drink.
That was 2 years ago.
Pat, are you not going to make it?
I'm not going to make it, unfortunately.
That's ancient history, right?
My nephew is graduating the same exact day from high school.
Okay. But Link and Pat, Link and Dan in. Are you coming, Alan?
Yeah, I'll be down there.
Okay, and I think Chad's coming, too. I think I heard Clawtoo's going to be there.
Yeah, Chad's 3:30
said he was going.
Yeah, I hope 3:30 comes.
3:30's going with his brother. Is Russ Werner going?
I think he is. One thing I should mention, if you want to get a room at the Comfort Inn, you need to mention that you want a one of the blocked rooms, because if you don't, they will probably tell you they're full.
No, actually, if you call in the evening, they'll tell you you're full whether or not you asked for it or not. We ran into that, and I had to call back during the day on it and then get the room that way.
Okay.
Well, I have a gut feeling that was the person who was on duty that night didn't really want to answer the phone. I got the impression.
I think I talked with that same person because
they got a bad apple over there.
Things, and I called to verify.
Someone's grumpy.
There's still a lot can go wrong, but I've been surprised at how well everything has gone so far. But it's not even started yet. Still got my fingers crossed.
I'm really looking forward to it.
I think it's gonna be real good. We got a lot of really good speakers. We don't have the website updated yet. We still got 12 speakers on the website, but we're gonna have 17 or 18 total. We have two keynotes and then three simultaneous tracks in between those. Some of the people that are coming, Iculus will be there. Alan Hicks that wrote the Slackware book, he'll be there. One of the people that wrote the Slackware book. Trying to think who else we've added. We decided a bunch of stuff last night and my brain's not totally working. But you know, check the website next day or so. We'll have that list updated. But it's amazing how much work it takes here towards the end. I think all I've done since I've come home from work is I bet I've sent 100 emails out today, just back and forth about this stuff. It's going to be good.
It better be, because I didn't listen to the damn preview promos for the past 18 months for a sucky.
But I think Tilt is going to have a little bit of competition. I think the Ubuntu podcast is going to be there.
Which one?
Punch him right in the freaking mouth is what's going to happen.
It's the one with Nick Alley. It's the Ubuntu podcast.
Oh, the guys
from Georgia,
from Atlanta.
Group. Yeah, that's them. They'll be there.
What the hell is that?
More American Idol tryouts.
Wow, you can't hear all the way out there.
Someone's
can hear
playing Doba.
Yeah.
Holy crap, I'm in another room.
Close the door.
Yeah, apparently.
Oy.
Yeah, the mic's a little bit hot, Corcon. You may want to turn the gain down just a bit.
Any better?
Oh my god.
Direction.
Wrong way.
See, this thing's backwards.
Now that we're deaf.
I didn't know it was time to pray towards Mecca.
Better go, guy.
Step in the right direction.
That's much better.
Gentlemen, anything else for this week?
I'm done for tonight.
I'm good, yeah.
Well, thank you all for coming on. Thank you, Thomas, who's already long gone. Next week we have, who do we have next week?
Jerry Ellsworth.
Yes, Jerry Ellsworth. And Joel set this up for us. He's really excited. So expect incredible audio from the get-go next week.
She seems to be a real hardcore hardware geek, this lady.
Yes.
She does that, Fat Man and Circuit Girl video podcast?
Yes. And you could see a lot of her talks on YouTube, which I encourage people to go take a listen to some of her stuff. It's really fascinating. So we will have her on next
She's
week.
Into the hardware hacking.
Yes. So tonight we have a selection from Jamando again.
It's, no Doba.
No, there'll be Doba, don't worry. Doba's after all this stuff. It's called Get Down from Shutterbox. And it's in the genre blues, and I hopefully you'll enjoy it. And Peter64 won't complain. So, if there's nothing else, gentlemen, I will play us out.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
See you next week.
Good night. Good night.
Anytime, Dan.
No, it's playing. This is really soft.
Okay.
Well, it was playing until Rhythmbox crashed on me. Hold on. I don't know. Who's laughing? It's not nice.
Gorkai.
Jerk.
No, that think that was me.
Here we go. Can you guys hear it at all? On the string from here. So mute your mics and shut up.
Bye. Southeast Linux Fest is a community event for anyone who wants to learn more about Linux and free and open source software. It is part educational conference and part social gathering. Like Linux itself, it is shared with the attendees of all skill levels to communicate tips and ideas and to benefit all who use Linux and free and open source software. The Linux Fest is a place to learn, to make new friends, to network with new business partners, and most importantly, to have fun. Come join us for the first annual Southeast Linux Fest on June 13, 2009 in Clemson, South Carolina. Register today at southeastlinuxfest.org.
It's a little thing tech show, and that's fact. If you don't like the guests, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies down a Lincoln bath. For the streaming, go direct to DLNGS.org. And IRC channels at LinuxThing.net. Bound tech show. Just sit right there, cause the castle's just about to begin.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
It's over.
Yes, it is over. It is over.
Stick a fork in it.
It is over. And with that, I will say goodnight to everybody.
Good night.
Have a good one. We'll talk to y'all next week.
Wop-pop-pop-pop-pop-pop. Hold. I hope to God that this is wrong. All right. Because you have demanded it. Your Doba pick of the week. Everybody's running. For those of you who don't know, Doba does have a MySpace page. So you can look them up. Dreamt of by Armadillos. Check them out. This is Siet Prime Complete, 35 minutes long, so you will be getting the first 10 or 11 minutes of it, not 35. So you'll have to come back next week for part 2 and the following week for part 3. So without any further ado, your Doba song of the week. Thank you. That was part one of Siet Prime Complete. Make sure you come back next week for part two and the following week for part three, because you know the year of Dobba just keeps going and going, and we're going to play them all of them, and you're going to love every stinking minute of it, because Dobba's awesome. Thank you for listening. Dobba.
Good. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good. We're waiting for you, pal. Now that you're here, we're all happy. Excuse me.
Root.
Who else just jumped in?
That's David.
Hey, Dave.
Dave who?
Hey, Dave.
Dave Yates.
Dave's not here, man.
Back from his vacation. He's on vacation, isn't he?
Now what?
Did you get some grilled chicken?
Are you tan?
Jerk chicken. No, I stayed under an umbrella the whole time.
You went to Jamaica and you didn't get a tan.
I didn't get burnt, put it that way.
Do you get tan? You look like you would get tan, Dan.
I tan easy enough. I don't burn that much, but I didn't want to get burnt.
We already got request from Dave to apologize.
I'm sorry.
Thomas, do you have a tan?
I have a farmer's tan.
You have a long
it's
one
I'll ever get.
Do you have a long commute into work?
Yeah, but it's mostly underground. It fosters this continuing feeling that I'm evolving into a Morlock.
That's cool. I'm sorry, Pat. Go ahead. You were saying.
I get plenty dark, man. It's that Mediterranean blood.
I only tan my arms because they stick out from the motorcycle.
Your elbows.
It's from like, you know, mid-arm down and my face. The rest of me burns to a crisp, so I don't even try it anymore.
Hey, any of you guys using this Ubuntu 1 file sharing?
No.
Service?
Not yet.
I got it set up. I need somebody to test it out with.
I'm waiting on the invite.
It installed a package on you. You download a package, you install it on your system. But there's also a web interface, too. Now, the web interface is cross-platform, obviously.
Do you have to be using Ubuntu to do it, though, don't you?
Not only if you want the client, the desktop client.
What's like a Dropbox type thing, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Alan, say something.
Testing. Hello, hello, hello. My name is Alan.
Thomas, can you say something, please?
Something, please.
There we go. That's great. Do you want us to call you Thomas or command line?
Either one.
All right. Dave, apologize for me,
yes.
Please.
I'm sorry, Dan.
All right.
No can do.
So there's no link tonight. And Joel might
Why
be on
Dave
later.
Why is Dave apologizing?
And, it's time to start the show. And that was KDE 4. All right. Dun, dun, dun. How many more weeks till self?
It's one calendar month. I don't know how many weeks that is. Let's look.
I figured you would know by all the way down to the minute, if not the second.
It's not many. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's 5 weeks on Saturday. No.
So I only have.
Yeah, that's right.
I only have to play this.
5 weeks.
This damn promo five more times?
Yep.
Actually, that'd be 10 more times because we play it going out, too. just so you know, Thomas. It's just a freewheeling show. No restrictions. You can say whatever you want. Know that we are live. We are recording. And that's it. So what we'll do is we'll play our intros and promos and do introductions and then get right to you in a few minutes.
Sure.
You're welcome to talk about anything or, you know, when we're done with the interview, you're welcome to stay on because we'll probably move on to some other stuff later on. You're welcome to stay on as long as you want.
Okay.
And if you want to come back next week, you can too. You got the number down. All right. So we're going to have about...
$29.
For what?
A Shure X2U, which is a XLR to USB microphone adapter.
I don't know whether it works for Linux or not. Can you guys hear the server fans in the background?
You're breaking up, Dan. You're breaking up.
No?
You're breaking up, Dan.
Can you hear server fans in the background? Am I still breaking up?
Yeah, kind of. Can't hear you, man. Now you're completely breaking up.
More power, Captain.
I can't take it!
Increase the bandwidth, Captain. You cannot change the laws of physics.
Is that better?
Not really, no.
Still sounds like gas.
Am I breaking up?
Yes, you are.
What'd you do?
Got his head underneath the water. He's got the microphone underneath the sink.
Dan needs to stop compiling kernels again. Get off the dryer, Dan.
Is that better?
Yeah, it's much better.
All right, let me know if I break up again, because if it happens again, I'm going to switch to the other system. This Wi-Fi is killing me. All right. Can you guys hear the server fans in the background?
A little bit, yeah.
All right, well, I'm going to be moving out of here in just a minute, so as soon as I'm done playing these intros. All right, so let's get it going.